From NPR News in New York, this is the Bryant Park Project with Allison Stewart and Luke Burbank.
It is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. News, information, and maybe a little bit of bacon. If you sign up for our email list, that's BACN. We'll explain that in a little bit.
You know, it still smells like sawdust in here. The mic, if you sniff...
Oh, well, we should explain
why. The mic, you can kind of smell... Because they just put this new table in for us to broadcast from, which is going to make the show 70% better. But it smells... You know how sawdust smells a little funky? I thought maybe somebody stepped in something, but...
No, I don't smell it. I got to be honest.
You can come over here later.
They're having olfactory issues over there.
We've got a lot of good stuff on the show today. I'm Luke Burbank, by the way. For those five people that didn't know that. We're going to talk about poverty, and you might be really surprised to find out who the U.S. government considers poor and who they consider at least to be above the poverty line.
We're also going to debut a new segment called Ripped Off from the Headlines, a story that somebody else did that was really good and we want to cash in on it, about office tyrants. You know that guy at the supply closet who just won't give you the Post-its? We'll discuss.
Or makes you work so hard for 80 cents in paper supplies. We're also going to have a music preview of some new stuff that's out this week that you're going to want to get your hands on. That's coming from our friend Erica Clark.
And a first person history. This week marks the anniversary of the Russian invasion of Czechoslovakia. We'll check in with someone who was actually there. We'll also have The Ramble and Matt Martinez with all the headlines. But first, here's today's top story.
President Bush spoke yesterday at a Veteran of Foreign Wars convention in Kansas City. The speech has been turning a lot of heads. Even today, he compared what's going on in Iraq to Vietnam, which is interesting on a variety of levels, not the least of which is that the administration has been really trying to avoid that comparison, you know, for a long time. Here's how he introduced this kind of Iraq-Vietnam comparison.
There's Vietnam. It's a complex and painful subject for many Americans. The tragedy of Vietnam is too large to be contained in one speech. So I'm going to limit myself to one argument that has particular significance today.
That main argument, the pullout from Vietnam resulted in tremendous death and destruction, and a pullout from Iraq would do the same thing.
One unmistakable legacy of Vietnam is that the price of America's withdrawal was paid by millions of innocent citizens.
Mr. Bush also quoted Osama bin Laden, of all people, as he tried to sort of connect Vietnam War protesters with folks who protest the Iraq War. Essentially, he was saying those who oppose the Iraq War are kind of unwittingly siding with the terrorists.
There's another price to our withdrawal from Vietnam, and we can hear it in the words of the enemy we face in today's struggle. In an interview with a Pakistani newspaper after the 9/11 attacks, Osama bin Laden declared that the American people had risen against their government's war in Vietnam, and they must do the same today.
So as you can imagine, this Iraq-Vietnam comparison touched off a few nerves, the nerves of families who have loved ones serving in Iraq, nerves of historians, some of whom seem the comparisons are valid, others say, what the? And, of course, the nerves of the people who served in Vietnam. Colonel Jack Jacobs is a decorated Vietnam vet who spent more than 20 years in the Army. He served in Vietnam. He's going to join us in a moment to talk about the president's speech.
This is NPR.
But first, here's Matt Martinez with the news.
Good morning, guys. Hello, everyone. Workers at the Crandall Canyon mine in Utah plan to drill a sixth hole to find six miners trapped in a cave since August 6th. Mine owner Bob Murray told NPR this will be the last hole drilled, and then it's over.
This mine is going to be sealed. I will never go back in there. The mountain is alive. It's a deadly mountain, and I'm not going near it.
More than 1,000 people have been flooded from their homes after heavy rains across the Midwest. Many of Ohio's rivers spilled over their banks. Thousands of homes were damaged in Wisconsin and Minnesota as the storm swept through. Ohio Governor Ted Strickland has declared northern parts of his state a disaster area. Add to this sweltering heat in the 90s and into the hundreds in parts of the Midwest. That's part of a heat wave that continues to bake the country's midsection and southern states today. The death toll from the heat has grown to at least 50, with one new death reported in Missouri and two in Alabama. Pakistan's Supreme Court says that former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif can return from exile. Sharif and another banished ex-premier, Benazir Bhutto, are vowing to return and lead a campaign to restore democracy there. They want to increase pressure on President General Pervez Musharraf to end 8 years of military rule. MySpace and MTV are hooking up. The two will host what are being described as real-time online dialogues with presidential candidates. Voters will be able to IM, email, or text their questions in real time. These dialogues will be held September through December. And the Texas Rangers set an American League record for runs scored in a game last night. They beat the Orioles 30-3 in the opener of a doubleheader in Baltimore. It was the most runs in a game since 1897, when the National League Chicago Colts set the all-time record with a 36-7 victory over the Louisville Colonels. I'm Matt Martinez. The news is always online at npr.org.
Chicago Colts or Cubs? Was there a Colts back there?
It was Chicago Colts back then, 1897. So says the fancy Associated Press.
Really?
You know, I don't know from the Colts, okay. So I'm just guessing.
We're going to continue on with our big story, which is 3 weeks to go before General Petraeus submits his status reports on the operations in Iraq. The president is going on a little bit of a speaking tour. Today, Mr. Bush will appear at the veterans group, the American Legion in Reno, to follow up on a speech yesterday, which made some wide-ranging comparisons between the Iraq War and other conflicts, World War II, Korea, and most, well, we'll say interestingly, Vietnam. Retired Army Colonel Jack Jacobs fought in... He earned 3 Bronze Stars, 2 Silver Stars, Purple Hearts, the Medal of Honor for his heroic acts in Vietnam. If you don't know Colonel Jacobs' stories, go to Google and look it up. It's just an amazing one. He joins us right now. Hi, Colonel.
Hi, good morning.
Let me get your baseline opinion on this. Do you think the one argument the president highlighted, that the United States should look to Vietnam for lessons about what can happen when troops are suddenly removed from a conflict, that Vietnam should be a reminder to us? What's your opinion of that argument?
Well, I think it's a bad analogy. Oscar Wilde said that the one thing we learn from history is that we don't learn from history, and that's certainly true. And Santayana's observation that those who ignore history are doomed to repeat it, but you've got to get your facts right. Otherwise, your argument looks rotten. I'm strongly in favor of doing the right thing and making sure that we achieve our military and political objectives in Iraq. But I think until recently, we've gone about it the wrong way, and we've lost 4 years in the interim. In the meantime, the president who... not all that long ago, said that Iraq and Vietnam are nothing at all alike, and I agreed with him then, is now saying exactly the opposite because he's focusing on withdrawal. The proximate cause of the loss of Vietnam was not our withdrawal. It was that we had an inexpert use of the military and political instruments of policy, followed very bad, particularly flawed strategies and tactics, never put enough troops in there to achieve the objectives, even if we had specifically articulated them, which we didn't, and continuously hamstrung our military in the achievement of what its objectives were. It's not quite the same thing as Iraq. Not only is the environment completely different and the war completely different, but also our objectives seem to be completely different as well. And it's a bad idea to make a bad argument because then nobody believes that you know what you're talking about.
Were you surprised the president decided to try to make this analogy?
I did. It was really astounding. And it's not the only one, the only flawed one that he made. Don't forget that it was the vice president who, 1994, said we shouldn't go into Iraq because we'll never be able to control it. But I guess it's okay to change your mind, but you should have some reasonable reason to change your mind. But he made other analogies which are not accurate as well. For example, he talked about how our withdrawal from Vietnam had a direct impact on the genocide that took place in Cambodia next door. Well, that's patently false. The troubles inside Cambodia started occurring long before we began withdrawing troops. And actually, both politically and militarily, our involvement in Vietnam had little, if anything, to do with what took place inside Cambodia. And I think the most striking analogy that he made that doesn't make any sense to me at all was the analogy to the Second World War, where we had a policy, an objective of unconditional surrender. And toward that end, you know, we did what we had to do in order to beat the bad guys, in addition of, you know, firebombing Dresden and Tokyo and dropping atomic weapons and so on, because it was vitally important for our national security if we to defeat these guys by whatever means possible.
I think something that's hard for a lot of people who sort of disagree with the war to take about what the president said was they feel like the president's basic point is Iraq is a disaster, or it's a problem in sort of similar ways as Vietnam was a problem. And if we pull out now from Iraq, there will be this sort of even more chaos. Those people who oppose the president would say, yeah, but we created the problem in the first place. Does the president, though, have a point in that things would get much worse in Iraq if we pulled out?
Well, there's no doubt about the fact that things will get much worse when we pull out, because the political situation there is unstable. There is fighting not just between Shia and Sunni, but between Shia and Shias. They're duking it out for control of various neighborhoods and turf, and that's going to continue. The real question is whether or not the fact that we've got a we waited 4 years before we started employing the correct techniques, which Petraeus is now using in Anbar province and a couple of neighborhoods in Baghdad, whether or not we have the political will to carry on doing what we're doing now in an expanded way over the next several years or so. If we had started doing what we're doing now 4 years ago, well, we'd be talking about how things are going swimmingly well, and we're about to start talking about withdrawing troops. But we got a late start because we followed a bankrupt strategy. And I think that the real question now is whether or not we have political will. I think the president is trying to, and properly so, trying to establish a base case so when Petraeus comes in about 3 weeks to talk to the Congress and the people about what his evaluation is, and he says, we're doing very well in a couple of places and we need to continue doing this well, so it's going to take a long time, that people who are listening to this will say, okay, if we're on the right track now, then we'll cut you some slack and we'll keep carrying on this line as long as we've changed our ways and are now doing the right thing, which I believe we are. But I think we're too far down the road now. There's very little political will to carry on, even if we are following the right strategy now. And more to the point, 162,000 troops is not nearly enough, not nearly what we're going to need in order to carry out a successful strategy in Iraq.
Colonel Jacobs, before we let you go, this is a little bit of a personal question, but I'm curious, as a veteran and someone who gave so much of himself during the Vietnam War, what do you think about the president giving these speeches in front of these particular groups, these veterans groups?
Well, you know, the whole question of the use of the military instrument in the defense of the Republic is an emotional one. And he's talking to an audience who is emotionally involved in defense. If you're a military person, you want to see an unfettered use of the military instrument, commensurate with proper mores and laws and so on. But you don't want to be hamstrung in the carrying out of your mission. And, of course, this audience he's talking to perceives, and properly so, that the military instrument has been shackled from the very beginning of our involvement in Iraq, from the very beginning of what is euphemistically called the war on terror, because we're trying to do it all on the cheap. And so naturally their response to somebody who's saying, listen, we've got to carry on and get the job done, is going to resonate. It resonates with me too. But at the end of the day, you have to have your facts right. Otherwise, the argument that you're making, whose objective might be an honorable one, is going to be denigrated by the use of improper analogies and incorrect history. I'm astounded that with the staff that the White House has, they weren't able to catch the inconsistencies in the analogies that he made. No, all for winning, all for securing the United States of America. And we've got to do it in a way which makes sense. It's an emotional issue, and that's not going to go away.
Retired Army Colonel Jack Jacobs. Jack, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Allison, I think this is one of those things where we've been, you know, reading a lot about this morning and listening to what the president said. And, you know, I kind of was alluding to it with the colonel, but I think the thing that makes people who oppose the war crazy is they feel like the president is picking – he said in that quote that we played, you know, I'm going to refine this to one argument.
Oh, yeah. Like every other argument, any other thing that you can compare Iraq to Vietnam, we're not talking about. We're talking about this one specific thing, and don't go outside of these boundaries.
Right. And because by maybe no coincidence, a lot of those other arguments would sort of maybe run counter to what the president's trying to say. So,
well, I read an article that talked about the White House strategy on this was they've had to be on the defense about Iraq. Iraq's comparison to Vietnam for so long that they have made the choice to go on the offensive about it and try to find some sort of positive correlation that works in their favor, and this is the one they came up with.
Yeah, and plus you've got this national intelligence estimate, kind of it's a sort of a mini update on what's happening in Iraq. Some of that was released today. Everybody's looking at September 15th, I think it is, when this big report is coming out, and people saying that the president is trying to kind of soften everybody up, get everybody ready. Like when I used to bring home a bad grade from school, I'd say, okay, Mom, have I told you how lovely you look in that dress? And then, hey, by the way. So some people think the president's kind of doing a, you know, political version of that.
A little prep.
Yeah.
Coming up, what's coming up?
We've got all kinds of things on the Bryant Park Project. We're talking about healthcare for middle-class people and more maybe to the point who the government considers poor and who they don't. You might be kind of surprised.
We're also going to do the ramble. A personal favorite of mine. One of the big stories, you don't want to be near Foxy Brown when you're getting your nails did. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
What about? Seriously? The power of love?
Where is Huey Lewis right now?
And more importantly, the news.
Well, we have the news.
Oh, yes, we do. On the Bryant Park Project from NPR News, I'm Luke Burbank.
And I'm Allison Stewart. Just a little bit, we're going to talk about office tyrants, those people that make you jump through hoops just to get a paperclip. You know who we're talking about.
Yeah, everybody has one or 10 of those people at their office.
But first, the news worth honorable mention, something we like to call the ramble.
I'm still reeling from an unexpected Huey Lewis in the news, a shot of Huey Lewis in the news. All right, Republican consultant Roger Stone left a profanity-laden and kind of threatening voicemail for the father of Eliot Spitzer. Eliot Spitzer is the governor of New York State. Somebody with the governor or his father hired an investigator to trace this call, and they found out it was probably this guy Roger Stone. It came from his house. So he said, I couldn't have made the call because on Monday night when the call was made, I was at an airing of Frost Nixon, which is this big hit play on Broadway. The only problem with that alibi, Allison, is that Frost Nixon doesn't actually show on Monday nights.
Oops.
It's like that's like from Encyclopedia Brown or some mystery. It couldn't have been
Monday.
Yeah. So anyway, get a better alibi, bro. It's like go online. What did that take? 5 minutes?
Yesterday, Foxy Brown going to jail. A year ago, she was sentenced to 3 years probation because she assaulted a couple of manicurists at a salon. You don't get your tips done right, Foxy gets mad. Last month, she violated probation by assaulting her Brooklyn neighbor with a BlackBerry. She actually showed up in court with a BlackBerry as well to show that she still had the weapon. She violated probation by leaving the state without permission, driving without a suspended license. She did not attend her anger management therapy. Let's just add in that she's pregnant, too.
Oh, my gosh. That's
makes the story a little better.
That's good for everybody. I think this is part where we do that. Allison, after the show, can we find a lake somewhere where I can lift you above my head?
Well, maybe I'll lift you above my head.
Oh!
How about them apples?
Wow, you just put your thing down, flipped it, and reversed it on me. I do have a kind of Swayze-esque mullet working right now. The studio behind the 1987 film Dirty Dancing is suing several clothing companies who have borrowed the famous line of dialogue, "Nobody puts baby in a corner." The American Film Institute, by the way, voted "Nobody puts baby in a corner" as one of the top 100 most popular quotes from a motion picture.
You mean so like if it's like a little onesie for some cute little kid that says "Nobody puts baby in the corner," they're going to sue that company for putting it on the little onesie?
It would appear so, according to this story, which, seems like a sad thing because that might be the cutest onesie you could ever put. And also, the American Association of Pediatrics recommends putting babies in a corner.
Only when they're bad.
Yeah.
Time out. You know that expression of spam. Everybody knows you get spam in your email box.
Yes.
How about this new phrase called bacon? B-A-C-N. That is the unwanted email, but that you actually signed up for. You know, like
right.
TravelZoo.com seemed like a good idea at the time.
Right. Or
I
like,
don't need to get those emails every week.
Facebook telling me that somebody looked at my wall. On like, oh, thank
exactly.
you for that update.
Did you know there's 20% off at Barnes & Noble today? I do. Because they sent it to both my email addresses. Well, there was this blogging and social media conference called PodCamp Pittsburgh last week, and the bloggers coined the term bacon on Sunday. Now, by Wednesday, it was the 14th most popular internet search term on Google, and it's still climbing. And we all wanted to know what it is. So we're checking in with Andy Quayle, who apparently was there. Hey, Andy.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
I'm doing okay. So did I do an okay description of what bacon is?
Pretty much, yeah. It's just the email you want, but not yet.
That's a brilliant name because, spam, I think most folks are not probably – well, I guess they sell a lot of spam, so maybe
sure.
It is popular. I personally don't like spam at all, but I kind of like bacon sometimes. So it's like – this is like one step above spam, right?
Exactly.
That's so perfect.
Can you use it in a sentence without feeling like an enormous dork?
Well, one of the first things I do in the morning is read through my bacon. Because as well as being a wonderful food, it normally Facebook and Twitter normally send out their bacon overnight. So, of course, you get it in the morning. And bacon is normally a breakfast meal.
Even more apt. Wait, now, do you know who exactly came up with this?
Well, there was a group of four or five of us sitting around a registration desk. There was myself, Jesse Hamley, Val and Jason Head, as well as Tommy Valier.
And was it just like
on the registration desk just talking about
something. Right when somebody said it, was it like
did
a light go off? Because I mean, that was it just like, oh yes, this is going to be awesome.
Pretty much within 15 minutes of the conversation getting going, we already had the domain registered, bacon2.com, and we already had the Twitter account set up, and we were all about it.
When are the t-shirts coming?
Well, there are t-shirts actually. There's bacon t-shirts on bacon2.com. Ready to buy right now.
Yeah.
The proceeds are actually benefiting the Humane Society of the U.S. and Invisible Children.
Just heads up. You can't use "Nobody puts bacon in a corner."
Pretty much.
Actually, now legally barred from that. Why did you guys leave the O out? Just to be cool?
And it's a Web 2 term, and we needed to define ourselves from the food somewhat. So in a Web 2 world, you're kind of missing vowels and things like that out of words. And it's quick and easy to type, and it's just, it kind of sticks in people's minds.
Before we let you go, Andy, is there any way you can explain to us how you came up with this on Sunday and it became the most searched term by Wednesday?
It's the Pittsburgh PodCamp, awesome event. People have got to go to it. But it's an event where lots of people in social media get together, bloggers, podcasters, and things like that. So it couldn't have been a really better medium to get the word out there, because we just started walking around saying it at the pod camp and explaining it to people.
One time at pod camp, there was this word called bacon.
Exactly. And people put on their blogs, on their podcasts, and out on Twitter, and it just got huge.
All right, I just want you to remember three words: Bryant Park Project at the next pod camp.
Yeah.
Andy Quayle, thanks a lot.
Thank you, guys.
Well, it was no invention of a new awesome web word, but there was a kind of a big story that was circulating last week, and in fact is going to sort of continue going, which is this discussion on Capitol Hill about healthcare. Now, hold on. Don't turn off your iPod or whatever you listen to this show on. This is actually pretty interesting stuff. Basically, there are a lot of people around the country who have jobs. They make more money than what's considered, you know, the poverty level in this country. And they sort of have too much money to be on Medicare. But for them to pay for their own insurance for them and their family is really, really expensive, thousands of dollars a month, which if you're making $45,000 a year right away, just, you know, is going to be more money than a lot of people can afford. So the government has this program that's called SHIFT, and basically what it does is it sort of helps those people at that level. Mm-hmm. But the president has been saying that a lot of people could be paying for their health care, people in the middle class, and they're using this program so they can spend the money on other stuff. So there's been this big kind of battle happening in Congress. The thing, though, that stuck out to us as we started looking at this was what the poverty line is in America for a family of four in the U.S. According to the government, if you are making more than $20,650 a year, you are above the poverty line. Which, think about being mm-hmm. a single person trying to live on $20,000. I mean,
but doesn't that also depend on where you live? There's got to be that sort of factored in too, because $20,000 is very different in, say, Dallas, Texas versus Moscow, Idaho.
Right, but it doesn't really account for that except for Alaska and Hawaii for some reason. Otherwise, if you're in the 48 contiguous states, it's kind of the same across the board. You're right, $20,000 in New York City is not $20,000 in Des Moines. So we were wondering exactly how the government sort of gets these numbers, and we've called up Helen Levy. She's with the Institute for Social Research at the University of Michigan. Hi, Helen.
Hi, how are you?
Well, first question, can a family of four live off of $20,000?
Well, about 12% of the population lives in families with income below that level. So the answer is yes, a pretty significant fraction of the population does.
What does that mean for a family if you're living at like $20,000, if you're a family of four? I mean, are you getting enough food every week?
Well, yeah. I mean, for the most part, families living in poverty are not experiencing hunger if you're talking about getting enough food. Now, it's a different thing to say, is it easy to get by? The answer to that, obviously, is no, it's not easy to get by in that amount of money. So I would say that, you know, if you're at the poverty line, you're struggling. On the other hand, the fraction of families experiencing hunger is only about 3 or 4% overall in this country.
How often do these poverty numbers get adjusted? And also, who actually decides? Who decided that in the first place, that $20,000 was going to be the cutoff for a family of four?
Well, the poverty level, the concept was developed in the 1960s by an economist at the Social Security Administration named Molly Orshansky. And she calculated how much it would cost for a family to feed themselves using what was called the Thrifty Food Plan, Department of Agriculture's eating plan for people without a lot of money. And then she noted that most households spend about a third of their income on food. So she took that number of what people would have to spend to cook the Thrifty Food Plan, and she multiplied it by three. And she said that number is the poverty level. And that is the calculation that's sort of still with us today. And what has happened since then is the number has been adjusted every year for inflation, but there really have not been other adjustments to how we think about what the poverty level is.
Is there any argument that, I don't mean this to sound cold-hearted, but that the numbers actually are okay if you think about how people in other places live, and if you said that even people that are at the poverty or a little below it are probably not going hungry? Is it just that we as Americans are used to such an extravagant lifestyle that, you know, look, people, you can live on $20,000, you can eat, you don't get to drive a Hummer, but maybe that's not such a bad thing? Is there any argument that the numbers are sort of, you know, okay in that sense?
Yeah, I mean, there is an argument, and you can find people who've published things on this that look at the material well-being of families with incomes below the poverty level. So they look at things like, do they have color televisions? Do they have air conditioning? Do they have VCRs? You know, do they own their homes? What do their homes look like? You know, you can do those calculations. And if you do them, you know, most people below poverty have a color TV, for example, and a VCR. Now, that's a different type of question from, are they financially secure? Do they have adequate retirement savings? Are they going to be able to finance some kind of education for their children? So I think it depends on what your criteria are, I guess.
This whole thing started off, for us anyway, talking about this health care and this issue of people that are kind of in between the very poor and the people who have plenty of money. What do you think is going to happen on Capitol Hill with this? Right now, Congress is sort of set to do battle with the president over it. Is this program that's known as SHIP, is this going to sort of be scaled down dramatically, you think?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, this is a very politically popular program. Everybody likes kids, and they're relatively cheap to insure because, fortunately, most of them are healthy. I would say that the Bush administration rules, which essentially say you got to enroll all the poor kids before you start extending coverage to kids at higher income levels, they are asking a lot of states because it's proved to be very hard to get all of the poor children to sign up for this program. So I don't know what's going to happen, but I would say that there's a real battle shaping up because the SCHIP program has a lot of bipartisan support, actually, since kids are so politically popular.
Right, right. Helen Levy with the Institute for Social Research at the University of Michigan. Thanks a lot.
Oh, you're welcome.
This is NPR.
It's time now to get you caught up on all the news headlines.
A sixth hole will be drilled at the Crandall Canyon mine in Utah. Mine owner Bob Murray says it'll be the final one. If there are no signs of life, he says the rescue operation will stop and the mine will close.
Pakistan's Supreme Court says that exiled former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif can now return to Pakistan. Sharif says he will return as soon as possible and contest elections to try to oust President Pervez Musharraf from office. Sharif was overthrown by Musharraf back in a 1999 coup.
Heavy rains in the Midwest flooded more than 1,000 people from their homes. The governor of Ohio has declared parts of his state a disaster area, and thousands of homes were damaged in Wisconsin and Minnesota as the storm swept through. Meanwhile, other parts of the Midwest and the South are dealing with a heat wave. The death toll from the heat has grown to at least 50 people.
They could just make the flood and the heat wave square
if
off.
Only.
Maybe have something. The Texas Rangers set an American League record last night for runs scored in a game. They beat the Baltimore Orioles 30-3. It was the most runs in a game in 110 years.
I beat you 10-1.
I'm sure some of those guys had literally pulled muscles from running around the bases so many times.
The news is always online at npr.org. A new segment that we want to introduce on the Bryant Park Project. Well, sometimes you see a news story that's just too great not to do, but someone else already beat you to the punch. So what do? You steal it. For this installment of Ripped Off from the Headlines, we turn to the Wall Street Journal for a column called How Office Tyrants in Critical Positions Get Others to Grovel. Lords of the Smaller Corners is how Jared Sandberg of the Journal describes these people who are imbued with just a little bit of power. Maybe it's over one thing. Supply closet. Maybe that security guard downstairs, Luke, the guy who makes you see your ID.
Yeah, we have a guy who literally, you come in and out of the building 10 times a day between getting coffee and whatever. This guy sees you 10 times a day. On the 10th time, if you don't have your ID, you're going back to the front desk to get a visitor pass.
Or maybe the branch manager of a cheesy chain who just says, just being a good waitress isn't enough.
We need to talk about your flair.
Really? I have 15 pieces on.
Okay, 15 is the minimum. Now, you know, it's up to you whether or not you want to just do the bare minimum. Or, like Brian, for example, has 37 pieces of flair on today. Okay? Mm. A terrific smile.
Office Space never gets old.
I've been meaning to talk to you about your flair.
You just have to settle down over there, mister. Jared Sandberg writes the column Cubicle Culture for the Journal. He wrote that article, and he joins us on the phone. Hey, Jared.
Hi, folks. How are you?
Doing great. So are these people you would normally find in the company flowchart?
You know, they would technically be in the hierarchical chart, the org chart. You would find them towards the bottom. And, you know, let's stipulate right now that they're power may be somewhat over-imagined, but it's also pretty real, because if any one of these people want to torch the productivity of your day, they can and they will. So, you know, you have to sort of recognize that that merely humoring them is often not enough. They have some, you know, they possess some real power that you don't see on the org chart, but in fact exists in other kinds of charts, such as influence and social networking and things like that, that do describe an organization and where people with, you know, influence, you know, who you should approach for certain things that might not be obvious from the org chart.
Yeah, you talk about that these people can become choke points or create choke points. Can you give me an example?
Well, you know, we've all seen, I think one of the most unsung sort of influence centers in any corporation are sort of the admins for the executive suite. You know, your future can very much depend on whether an admin likes you or not. So that's one. But, you know, you can see it throughout an organization, and it may not, they may not be positions that have something to do with revenue generation, as wonks like to say. It may be in the travel department. It may be in the HR department. Certainly it's in, you know, purchasing, shipping, receiving. All of these things, all of these people actually have, do possess a real power, and you know it because when they are not cooperative with you, you feel it.
It's so funny. Before we saw this story, I hadn't really thought of it, but the people I suck up to the most are not our bosses.
Mm-hmm.
It's the people that are at various levels of the NPR kind of, you know, chain that can totally make our life hell.
Well, I'm embarrassed to say that I groveled shamelessly several weeks ago when I was at the DMV. A woman who could have easily overlooked a minor, you know, technical issue, i.e. my wife's signature, didn't, and so I had to go back and wait online again at the DMV. Yeah, no, I agree with you, Luke. I think you're absolutely right. As I like to say, it's good to have friends in low-level places, because those are the people who are going to, you know, allow you to get your job done. And, you know, if you define authority like I do pretty expansively, which is anyone who can, you know, anyone possesses authority if they can ruin your day, then you can see all the different corners of the office that are important to you and legitimately important to you. As I said, I mean, I caution against simply humoring people or looking down your nose at anyone who might be low on the org chart, because the fact of the matter is that, you know, we all depend on each other, and, you know, your productivity is only as good as its weakest, laziest link.
Jared Sandberg writes the column Cubicle Culture for the Wall Street Journal. Hey, thanks for letting us rip off your article. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
If you have any examples in your life of gatekeepers, keymasters, pain in the tushes, email us here at thebryantpark@npr.org. Just bryantpark@npr.org.
Now anyone I'm nice to is going to think that I'm being nice to them because I think they're a nobody.
I thought about that. Buddy, you got a lot of explaining to do.
All right, coming up, speaking of people who are somebody, Erica Clark from AmplifierMagazine.com is going to be here to talk about new music.
And a first person history with our director's mother-in-law. It has nothing to do with their wedding or why he's a good or bad son-in-law. She was actually present at the Russian invasion of Czechoslovakia. It happened in the spring of 1968. She was a college student. The anniversary is this week. We'll talk to her. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. Welcome back. I'm Luke Burbank. This is the sound styling of M.I.A. This is the track Boys off her new record, Kala, that comes out in the U.S. this week. Speaking of music releases this week, we've got us some Erica Clark here. She's a writer for Amplifier magazine. She's here to take us through some of the more notable stuff that's coming out recently. Hi, Erica.
Hello. How are you doing?
I'm great. Okay, M.I.A.
Yes.
Who is she, and what's this new record all about?
Okay, M.I.A., Sri Lankan rapper from Britain via Sri Lanka. Mm-hmm. She was a refugee. Everyone knows the whole backstory. Came here with her family, came to the U.K. anyways. This is her second album, Kala, named after her mother. And she claims it's less political than her last album, but she still is doing that whole kind of like third world democracy. Mm-hmm. Let's have a voice for the oppressed and the quote unquote the other, because she is one of the other. And it's a, I have to say, overall, it's a fun dance record. You know,
you can do fun dance democracy.
You can, shockingly enough. You're like,
doesn't
oh,
all
wow.
have to be Rage Against the Machine.
Exactly. You know, a little touch of it. You're dancing, and then you're like, wait, maybe I should go on a website and learn about what's going on in, you know, Liberia.
I gotta
maybe.
just objectify for a minute and say, any website that has a photo of MIA mm-hmm. on it, I'm there. She's a
babe.
She's a nice looking young lady. Well, let's hear another track off that. This is Mango Pickle, Downriver.
When the street up, we got a river to swim. Women go fishing, we catching a brim. When the river's on, we jump off the bridge. When we get on, we play some deep.
Call me Wally, this way I'm at.
Now, I have to say, I really liked her first record. I feel like this one is a little... That's a very catchy song,
right.
As is the song we started with. Some of them are a little bit almost kind of arrhythmic, you know? I don't know, maybe I'm not good at dancing, but some of the rhythms are... It's very kind of mixed up and kind of... It sounds a little different than the first record.
Right.
So I would say preview it if you like the first record and you're going to buy this one. Maybe preview it on iTunes first.
Preview it, but I have to say, it's like she didn't even believe in the sophomore slump. Shockingly enough, it's like... The confidence level on this album is amazing.
All right, well, from Sri Lanka and London to Silver Lake in Los Angeles, a band called Rilo Kiley also has a new album out this week. It's called Under the Black Light. Tell me a little bit about Rilo Kiley.
Rilo Kiley, this is their fourth album, first full length for Warner Brothers, actually first label album for Warner Brothers. It's a departure. Critics and some fans are freaking out a little bit because it's not as indie rock and alt country sensible mm-hmm. as the last album. A mm-hmm. little more disco rock kind of beats on it. But it's a really, it's a Jenny Lewis album. It really is. It sort of feels like maybe she took a lot from her solo album. Excuse me.
Yeah, Jenny Lewis is the lead singer of Rilo Kiley.
Exactly.
She also sang with the Postal Service, and she's kind of the Jenny Riley, the Jenny Lewis brand has kind of blown up a little bit. Let's actually hear something off of this new Rilo Kiley record. This is called Close Call.
Her good looks could have sailed the ship, but her will alone could have sunk it.
Very Edie Brickell in the New Bohemians or something.
Ooh, that's, wow.
I'm going back in the archives.
I'm seeing videos and long hair now.
Do you like this album?
I do. I have to say, like, I've actually gotten to a couple of disagreements with people already about they're like, well, it's not Rilo Kiley. It doesn't feel like it. And I'm like, well, they've done Rilo Kiley, and it's a new album, and that's all right. And she has a beautiful voice. More importantly, I mean, you put her out front, just milk the vocals. It's gorgeous.
Yeah, it's a kind of a dilemma, I think, if you're a band, because if you make every record sound the same, then you're not moving forward as a band. But if you try to change up your sound,
your fans get all ugly about
it. And
you're
a sellout,
right,
you know.
Right. So there's another album that comes out this week that's, I have to say, I like some parts of it more than I think I should, which is, I guess, appropriate, because it's called Guilt by Association. It's put out by Engine Room Recordings, and it's a bunch of sort of cool acts like Will Oldham, Bonnie Prince Billy, and guys from Luna and the Stooges. They're covering like Guilty Pleasure songs, High School the Musical and things like that.
Exactly.
It's, you know, well, let's just start off by hearing one of the songs off of there. This is a cover of Don't Stop Believin'.
Just a small town girl living in a lonely world. She took the midnight train going anywhere.
That's Petra Hayden. That's a beautiful song.
And she does, if you can track it down, she does a beautiful cover of God Only Knows. She does great covers. I mean, beautiful. And it's, there's no like, ha-ha, I'm being ironic.
That's my question. Is this record some of that sort of hipster irony stuff that can get really tired really fast, in my opinion?
You know, there are a few tracks where you're like, ha-ha, I got it.
Yeah.
That's cute. Good luck with that. And then there's others where there's a singer-songwriter by the name of Casey Shea who covers System of a Down. Chop suey. Shocked. I'm listening to it, and then I have to go back to the System of a Down song. Mm. Two different things, but he does such a beautiful, non-funny take of it.
Actual interpretation
exactly.
of the song versus
it's beautiful.
Sort of goofing on the concept.
Right. It, you know, it depends, I think, really what mood you're in also when you're listening to it.
Yeah, I just had been to so many concerts where these sort of hipster bands at the end would do Back That Ass Up or something, you know, and it's like I'm sort of over the irony, but I have to say some of the songs on this record are so well executed. From what I've listened to, that, you know, it's pretty listenable stuff. All right, well, let's move on to All Night Chemists, and let's hear a track off of there. Is it a self-titled record?
This is album's called Spots, second album.
Okay, this is their second album from All Night Chemists, and let's hear a song off of that. Do you know what that song's called, Erica?
It's Wake Up. It's the first track on the album.
Wake Up.
Yes, sir.
From the All Night Chemists. They're a Brooklyn band.
Brooklyn band. Actually, it is a gentleman by the name of Lynn Monachello. Mm-hmm. He does everything. He wrote, produced, engineered the album. And it's pretty much his outfit. He's like Cat Power. Mm. But he has backing members with him.
Yeah, yeah. I have to. I don't know if this is bad form when someone comes in to present you with new music.
Okay.
I was a little. I bet this guy is an exceedingly nice fellow and a very talented guy. I kept waiting for something on the record to kind of jump out at me.
Okay.
It felt a little bit like background to me. And lyrically, there were a couple things. I mean, these are actually some of the lyrics. All those yellow roses in a row keep melting in the wake of what we can't control. Maybe that's not fair because you could deconstruct any lyrics, but
right.
I don't know. I felt like you feel like there's some texture to this? I felt like it was kind of monotone.
Well, you know what? I feel like it's great. It is great for the background music. I also feel like it has a familiar lived-in mm-hmm. vibe, too, where I kind of want to hum along to it. Mm. And there's something very, like, comforting about certain artists like that mm-hmm. where you can't sort of... You might not necessarily right. decide that's my favorite lyric, but it's something
right.
that feels, you know, oh, I want to listen to that a little bit longer.
Sure.
You know, great live performer. Great live performer.
Yeah, okay, okay. That's the All Night Chemists, and that's their record. What's the record called again?
It's called Spots.
Well,
self-released.
Let's see. What else are we supposed to talk about with Erica? Is that it, guys? Are we out of music?
I think we're done.
How could that even happen?
I'm like, hey, let's just riff.
Yeah, yeah. Let's riff. What are you? Oh, you know why I got confused? Because the clock stopped there at 1:30. That's why I kept looking up at it and going, "We have more time with Erica
You're
Clark.
Like,
this
hey,
is beautiful.
Let's just talk."
So listen, because you actually review music.
Yes.
Do all your friends look to you as the kind of like guiding light on stuff? Is that a lot of pressure?
I have to say, a huge chunk of my friends are like. Music gurus where it's like, have you heard this MP3? Have you heard this one? I stopped being very self-righteous probably when I was like 28, 29, where I was like, I know it all, you know?
Yeah. But, I think that's going to be my mid-30s when I stop being self-righteous.
Oh, let me lie. I'm still self-righteous to a different degree now. you know.
All right. Erica Clark, a writer for Amplifier Magazine, thanks a lot for bringing us up to speed on what's happening in the music world.
Thank you so much, folks.
Let's kick it over to Matt Martinez with the latest headlines.
This is NPR.
Thanks, guys. Here's what's on our radar right now. A sixth and last hole being drilled in a Utah mine. The mine owner says if there are no signs of life, the search is over and the mine will close. British Airways has admitted to price fixing on international flights. The U.S. Justice Department has fined the airline $300 million. Pakistan's Supreme Court has told exiled former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif that it's okay to come back. He says he will. And MySpace and MTV are teaming up to hold real-time online dialogues with presidential candidates. Voters will be able to IM, email, or text their questions in real time. These stories are always online all the time at npr.org. I'm Matt Martinez.
Every time around this time of year, Beloit College releases a list of events and benchmarks that incoming college freshmen have or have not happened during their lives. For example, at number one on the list this year, what Berlin Wall?
No.
Yeah, that's number one.
For you mean they don't know about the Berlin Wall or they haven't?
They have. There's no reason for them. They were born in 1989. Nelson Mandela's always been free. These students have never had to roll down a car window. It's always been electric.
No, you know what, Dan Pashman's just clarifying that they didn't live through it. Maybe they've heard of it, but they weren't alive when it happened, which still makes me want to break up my acid-wash jean jacket and cry to Scorpions, Winds of Change.
One of the things on the list is American rock bands have always appeared in Moscow. These people could not imagine Russians, then Soviets, invading another country just because people decided to express some freedoms. Well, some college-age kids did experience that exact event this week, 39 years ago in Prague, when Soviets arrived in Czechoslovakia. It marked the end of what's called the Prague Spring. It was a name given to the few months when Czechs were really enjoying freedom of press. There was a rise in consumer goods. It was a walk towards a multi-party political system. They had a charismatic new leader. That is until the Soviets walked in and said, "Niet," rolled their tanks into town. Now, someone who was there and was a college student at the time is the mother-in-law of our show's director, Dan Pashman. Her name is Alice Fossner, and she joins us on the phone. Hi, Ms. Fossner. How are you?
Hi, I'm wonderful.
Thank you so much for joining us. Do you remember the day, what it was like when the Soviet tanks rolled into Prague?
Yes, I remember today what it was like when the tanks rolled into my city. I lived in Košice, which is in the eastern part of what was then Czechoslovakia, now Slovakia. And it's a fairly large city with a lot of universities. And it was a Wednesday, and it was a total shock. And we were all in a state of disbelief. Yeah, very unforgettable. I was 21 at the time, and life was so good.
Explain to me, when you say life was so good, what was it like in that period called the Prague Spring between January and August? What kind of changes had happened that you noticed?
It's hard to explain for someone that hasn't lived it. I was born into the communist regime and was the only thing I had ever known. And it was what it was. And that year, in 1968, things just started to ease up. All of a sudden, we started to read in the papers and hear on the radios that everything isn't so perfect and we can do something about it. And it was like fresh air was being pumped into the country. It was very exciting and was wonderful. And we thought, being young people and idealistic, we felt so great being part of it. And we thought we could still maintain communism, but it was going to be this much better form of communism where we can offer people freedoms to do and say and function with someone looking over their shoulders and controlling them all the time. It was really great, and students started to meet, and we were talking things, and we loved our leader. There was this unity. It was just... it's hard to explain. The atmosphere was just good. Everything felt good. We loved the leadership, and until then, no one really cared about the leaders. It was something really good, and we did not expect. We knew what happened in Hungary in 1956, but what was happening in our country was different. It was a slow process, and we didn't want to overthrow the regime. We just wanted to make it more human, better.
How long was that little sort of utopian period, a few months?
It really didn't exactly start in January. It was probably close to a year when we started to see a slow progression. You know, writers started to write things in the papers that we never read before. There was this slight criticism was allowed, and everything wasn't this perfect that it always was supposedly the way it was described in the papers. And at the universities, you can just imagine, it was wonderful.
Mrs. Fosner, how has your perception of the Soviets changed once the invasion happened? What was it before, and then what did it become?
The Soviets, to us, were always our big brothers. They were our big brothers who liberated us after World War II, and they were this big protector, big brother to us. And we just kind of accepted that. And we were kind of like this maybe younger sibling trying to do things a little bit their own way. And when the tanks rolled in, we just couldn't believe it.
Is it kind of challenging for you? Because I think a lot of people haven't really heard about this kind of one-year period in Czechoslovakian history. But it was such a huge thing for you because you lived through it. Do you find yourself constantly recounting it for people or trying to explain sort of what a substantial thing it was for you?
I think as much, I haven't done it recently. You know, you have to realize it's almost 40 years, and I have lived a different life now, and it was hard. You know, when people say freedom, it means different things to different people, and it was quite an adjustment to getting used to this new freedom found in this country. But, and I don't think it's anything that anyone that hasn't lived in a communist regime could possibly really grasp the whole thing. We didn't want to make it into a small America or a small West. It was just incredible that we couldn't pursue this slow, gradual change to still be a socialist / communist country with this human face on it, that we could still be our own person, not something pre-programmed. And it was devastating. It was absolutely devastating that they would actually do this.
Mrs. Alice Fosner, we really appreciate you joining us today and sharing your memories of the Prague Spring. And we like Dan.
I love him. He's wonderful. And I think because of our family discussions on this subject often, I think Dan has a pretty good picture of what happened then.
What a son-in-law.
And
what a son-in-law.
And what a director of the Bryant Park
Absolutely.
Project. That's Mr. Dan Pashman. Also see MJ Davis, producer extraordinaire. Laura Spohr.
What a
producer. Yes, Lauren, Dan's mother-in-law loves you too. And Manoli Weatherall, who engineers the show, and Matt Martinez, who's our newscaster.
And senior supervising producer.
Oh,
I'm Allison Stewart. I'm a host chick.
I'm Luke Burbank. Thanks for listening.